An Osho Talk.
God is dead. Now Zen is the only living truth.
Number 5.
Sukhito wrote, "The mind of the great sage of India was intimately communicated from India to China. In human beings there are wise men and fools, but on the way there is no northern or southern teacher. The mysterious source is clear and bright. The branching streams flow through the darkness. To be attached to the relative, this is illusion. But to take to oneself the absolute is not enlightenment. Each and all the elements of the subjective and objective spheres are related and at the same time independent. Related, yet working differently, though each keeps its own place. Form makes the character and appearance different. Sound, taste, smell distinguish comfort and discomfort. The dark makes all things one. The brightness makes all things different. The four elements return to their nature as a child to its mother. Fire is hot, wind moves, water is wet, earth hard. Eyes see, ears hear, the nose smells, the tongue tastes, one salt, another sour. Each is independent of the other, but the different leaves come from the same root."
Friends, first the questions. The first question: could one summarize the difference between a God-oriented religion and the quality of religiousness as the difference between a judge external to us, a projected conscience, and a witness within our consciousness? The difference between God-oriented religions and the religions without God is immense. The God-oriented religions are simply fiction. Lies told again and again and again. Almost start appearing to be true. God as the ultimate lie creates many lies around itself, because no lie can stand alone, because no lie is self-evident. it needs other lies to support it. Hence, all God-oriented religions have created many lies to support God. Truth can stand on its own legs, but not a lie. Truth needs no argument, but not a lie. Lie needs many arguments, many fabricated proofs, many imaginary evidences. Truth is utterly naked. Either you know it or you don't. God-oriented religions are a disease of the soul, sickness of the mind, because God is only your fear, your dread, your anxiety, your insecurity. And then comes prayer, and then comes the priest, and then comes the organized religion, the church. True religiousness cannot be God-oriented. True religiousness is your own interiority, your own inner space. And you can see the differences between these two kinds of people. Those who follow the God-oriented religion don't show any compassion, don't show any ecstasy, don't show any blissfulness. On the contrary, they are very violent. They are very against freedom. They are in constantly fear that somebody will object to their lies and they will not be able to answer it. Because all that they have is only a belief system. A belief system can only help you to forget your ignorance, but it does not destroy it. So the God-oriented man lives in ignorance and believes that he knows. And just mere words, theories, hypotheses are not going to change your character. They can at the most make you a hypocrite. They can give you a beautiful mask, but not the original face. They can create a very convenient personality, but they cannot create or discover your beautiful individuality. And the personality, however convenient, is a heavy weight on your chest, on your heart, because you are living a lie. Nobody can feel at ease when he is living a lie. The man who has no belief system but has encountered truth himself suddenly finds himself changing into a new man. There is no effort involved. Grace comes by itself, compassion comes by itself, violence disappears, fear disappears, death and birth disappear. One starts feeling at home with the universe. There is no tension. One is absolutely relaxed. This is our home. One stops searching and seeking. One starts living, dancing, loving. Knowing one's own interiormost center is also knowing the center of the universe itself. Doors of all the mysteries open. Not that you start getting answers, you become more mysterious. All answers are mind products. Questions arise out of the mind, and answers are also of the same mind. Neither the questions lead you towards the truth nor the answers. Answers only repress your questions, but they will surface again and again. A man without God finds himself into total aloneness. He has nowhere to go except within words. All roads leading out are meaningless. They don't lead you anywhere. Because there is nobody outside, a God, a paradise. Removing God is a great rebellion and an absolute necessity to be awakened, to be enlightened. God is holding millions of people outside their own consciousness. And God being a fiction, your prayer is false, and your religiousness is imposed. Hence, all these religions demand, do this, don't do that. Everything is imposed from the outside. And whenever something is imposed from the outside, your dignity is destroyed. Your individuality is crushed. Your freedom turns into slavery. And the ugliest slavery is the spiritual slavery. With God, you can only be a slave. With God, you can never be liberated. Liberation begins with liberating yourself from God and all the lies that surround Him. Liberation brings you to your own very center. And there you find a totally different experience that is not of the mind, of pure silence, truth and beauty, of eternity, of life as a constant festival. And because you experience this festivity inside you, it starts overflowing you. In your actions, you become graceful. Your eyes start shining with love, with depth. Your very movement shows a centered, balanced, harmonious being. Your words carry something of that which is beyond words. Your silence is no more the silence of a cemetery. It is not dead. It is very alive, throbbing. It has a heartbeat. It is a silent dance of pure awareness. It is a silent song without any sounds. But it is immensely alive. Anything imposed from outside destroys you, your freedom, your individuality, your inner space is completely closed. And it is closed in such a beautiful way that you never think that your parents, your teachers, your priests, your leaders, politicians, all kinds of so-called wise men are poisonous. With all good intentions, they are poisoning every child. And God is the original sin. Original sin because we created a great lie, ultimate lie. Once I was in a court for the first time, in a strange case, there used to be a Christian church, a very beautiful church with a vast ground around it, huge ancient trees, because you will be surprised that the Indian Christianity is the oldest Christianity in the world. Jesus Christ, one of the closest disciples, Thomas, came to India directly. His gospel is not included in the Bible because his gospel was written in India, and it is the most beautiful gospel. Those four gospels included in the New Testament are nothing compared to it. Thomas became a transformed man here because he started seeing the difference between God-oriented religion and a religion without a God. A religion without a God gives man dignity, because man becomes the ultimate evolved consciousness in the whole existence. It gives man freedom from a burden imposed by the priest in the name of God. And you have asked, could one summarize the difference between a God-oriented religion and the quality of religiousness as the difference between a judge external to us? There is no judge. And there is no religiousness in a God-oriented religion. It is mere theology. It is a mind project. It is not existential, it is not experiential. And you are asking, that could one summarize the difference between a God-oriented religion? First, remember, the God-oriented religion is only a name. God is fiction, so anything oriented in God cannot be anything else but a lie. And secondly, you are asking, and the quality of religiousness, the God-oriented so-called religion, has no religiousness to it. It has a certain morality. It has a certain imposed discipline against nature. God is the enemy of nature, because nature is truth and God is a lie. But the lie is dominating millions of people and to withdraw from the nature, which is the only truth. So there is no religiousness in a God-oriented person. What he has is a morality which is nothing but a social convenience. It differs from place to place, from country to country, from race to race. What seems to be religious to one fragment of humanity is not religious to another fragment of reality. Because every society has its own climate, its own heritage, its own past, which is different from other societies. For example, the Hindu conception of heaven is that of a centrally air-conditioned place. Not that they have used the centrally air-conditioned word, but they say the whole day cool breeze, fragrant billows, it is never hot in heaven. Obviously, it shows that the people who have projected this lie are living in a hot country. and they don't want to live eternally into a hot place. The Tibetans have their heaven very warm. No snow at all. No winter ever happens in their heaven. They are suffering from cold and winter and snow. They are projecting something which they can tolerate eternally. This life is small, but to suffer the same thing eternally will be too much. Human mind is too frail, too weak. Just watch out what each country thinks as religious. In India, you have to take a morning bath before the sunrise and do your prayer, and only then you can eat anything, your breakfast, not before that. In the religious scriptures of Tibet, it says you should take a bath at least once a year. But the trouble is that people go on carrying their conception, even though they move into different climates. One of my friends, a very scholarly Brahmin, wanted to go to Tibet. He was very much interested in Tibetan language and Tibetan scriptures. I said to him that all that literature is available. You don't have to go to Tibet, and you will not be able to remain there more than 2 days. He said, why? I said, how you will manage a bath before sunrise and without a bath, you cannot take your breakfast. You cannot eat anything unless you do your prayer. But the prayer needs an absolute necessity that you take a bath. But he didn't listen to me. He went to Tibet and just after 2 days, he was back. He could not exactly reach Lhasa. He returned back from Ladakh. It is just in between Tibet and India. Even Ladakh gave him so much trouble. Taking an early morning bath in Ladakh can kill you. It is ice cold. So he came back. He did not go further. I said, what happened? It is just 2 days and you are back? He said, you were right. I am a Brahmin and I follow my religion. I cannot remain without a bath. Tibetan Lamas have come with Dalai Lama. As Dalai Lama escaped from Tibet when China invaded it, so hundreds of Lamas have come with him. I was taking a camp in Bodh Gaya, the place where Gautam Buddha became enlightened. Exactly in the same campus, by the side of the same tree, I was taking a meditation camp. And a group of Tibetan lamas came to pay their respects to the tree under which Gautam Buddha had become enlightened. And you will not believe, even from far away, they stink. Because they are still following the idea that you should take one bath every year in India. And it was hot summer and they were perspiring, and they are still using the same kind of clothes as they used in Tibet. Layer upon layer. There are many layers of clothes. And they are so dirty, so oily, and dust has been gathering on the oily clothes. They were good in Tibet. They prevented anything, any cold, reaching to the person's body. But in India, they have not changed. I asked them, do you understand, all kinds of so-called religions are social conveniences. It was good in Tibet, but here you are being stupid. So many layers of clothes upon clothes, you are being insane. But they said, our religion says, one bath a year is absolutely necessary. More than that is luxury. More than that is condemned. It is dangerous. And to make people afraid that if you go against the dictations of your scriptures, you will fall into hell. So they said, it is better to stink than to fall into hell. I said, that's right. You are already in hell. Even I don't think the devil is going to allow you into hell. Because never, in no scripture of the world, it is said that devil stinks. He is a gentleman. A nice fellow. I said to those people that you just keep on these clothes in India and they will save you from hell. As the devil will start stinking you, he will close the doors. Tibetan lamas no more allowed. You go to the other place. Jesus used to drink alcohol. Now, in India, no religion can conceive a man of understanding, a man who is enlightened, will drink alcohol. I don't see any problem. Because if the body is illusory, the alcohol is going into the body, not into the soul. It is called spirit. Don't think that it is spiritual. It does not go into your spirit. It may affect your mind and you may fall unconscious, but still it is not touching your consciousness at all. Because the mind and brain are part of the body. Mind is the program and brain is the computer that is programmed. When a child is born, he has a brain but no mind. Mind is nothing but the whole collect information, knowledge. It is programming. So, the brain will be affected by alcohol, but not your spirituality. So what is the problem? To me there is no problem. Even a Buddha can once in a while have a little drink, enjoying a little party, Italian style. In Italy, party means something absolutely different than you understand. It is real party. With two partners. But why prohibit a Buddha from enjoying a little party? A little spaghetti? A little wine? All these things are material and they don't touch your spiritual being. But in India, nobody can conceive that Buddha can drink. Even tea, he will not drink. One cannot think of Mahavira . The reason is simple. In this hot climate, drinking alcohol is not needed. But in a cold climate, alcohol is absolutely necessary. It keeps you warm. It does not make you intoxicated, it only keeps you warm. And there is no harm to feel warm when snow is falling all around you. So in a cold country, the morality will be different. In a hot country, the morality will be different. This is just an example. On every point, different climates will create different moralities. Muhammad said to the Mohammedans that you can marry 4 women. The reason was that in Saudi Arabia at that time, 1400 years before, the proportion between men and women was 4 women, 1 man. And it happened because the men were continuously fighting. It was a tribal world, and every tribe was fighting with another tribe. Of course, men were being killed, and women remained. So the proportion became such that there were 4 women to 1 man. So I don't condemn Muhammad. He was making it convenient to the society. Otherwise, what 3 women will do? They will disturb the whole society. They will start having love affairs with married people. They will become prostitutes. And such a vast number of prostitutes will create so much ugliness and perversion. It was better that a man marries 4 women. And strangely enough, I have been in deep contact with few Mohammedans who have been my friends, I was amazed. I used to think theoretically that one woman is enough to drive a man either insane or enlightened. Only two alternative. One woman. What four women will do to a man? But my actual experience when I came into contact with Mohammedans who had four wives was totally different. That's what I always say, that theoretically something may look logical. Life has no obligation to follow your logic. I was surprised that the Mohammedan house has no quarrel the way one man, one woman are continuously nagging and fighting and jealous. The reason is those four women are fighting amongst themselves. The man is simply out of. They are not much concerned about the men. The whole question is about four women. So the man is far more happier than anybody who lives with one woman. I asked those friends that what is the matter? One woman drives people either insane or they renounce the world. Really it is renouncing the woman and they become enlightened. And now I understand why no Mohammedan has ever been enlightened. They are very normal people. They don't go even insane either. It is those four women fighting amongst themselves and the man is simply out of the game. He can watch the game, but he is no more part of it. But now the proportion is not the same. In a country like India, the proportion is exactly the same. And now, even in Saudi Arabia, the proportion is exactly the same. Now to go on marrying four women in Saudi Arabia will create problem and inconvenience to the society. Because three men will be left without wives. Now these three men will create trouble. They will have love affairs with other people's wives. And always remember, the other person's wife is far more beautiful than your own wife. Far more greener. Just as the lawn of the neighbor looks so green that you want to chew it. The neighbor's wife also you want to chew. The French actually has the expression. When you are in deep love, in France, tell to the woman, I want to eat you. And she will be immensely happy. But only French do that much. If you say that thing in India, that I want to eat you, the woman will give such a scream. And soon you will be arrested by the police. That what you said to that woman, that why she was screaming so loudly. And if you say, I was just telling her I love you, and I told her I want to eat you, even language changes just as morals change, as religions change, according to climate, according to tradition, according to their past. I have heard about a very great French warrior. In the Middle Ages, the warriors were always going for a crusade. Christians were going to kill Mohammedans and they were going to kill Jews or convert them into Christians. Only chance was, if you want to live alive, be Christians, otherwise be finished. So the warrior was going, but he had a very beautiful wife. In the Middle Ages in Europe, they used to have locks. When the husband will go for a few days out, he will put a certain lock on the woman's vagina. It was a belt with a lock. And strange locks were developed. So nobody can make love to the woman, because few locks which richer people used had a knife inside. Anything entering into the lock, the knife will simply fall on. They are already exhibited in great museums of Europe, particularly in London. So the warrior was going for months, or maybe it will take a year or 2 years. So he loved his wife, but he was worried to take the key with himself, because it is war. If the key is lost, then it will be very difficult to open the lock. You will have to call some goldsmith and somebody who can make another key. But it will be very embarrassing. So he called his best friend and he told him that I am going in a crusade and I trust you, you are my best friend. So keep this key. When I will come back, I will take the key from you. This is the key of my wife's lock. The friend said, don't be worried. And just 5 minutes after, the warrior has gone on his horse, he saw his friend coming fast on his horse. He stopped the horse. What is the matter? The friend said, you have given me the wrong key. Just 5 minutes after. When there are people not in proportion, it is good what Muhammad said. There is nothing wrong in it. But it belonged to his time and the situation. it has become a rule amongst Mohammedans. And because they cannot find so many wives in their own religion, they go on abducting other people's wives. In India it is a game. You just catch hold of somebody's wife, and Hindus are very fussy about it. Once the wife has remained one night outside the house, finished. She cannot enter in the husband's house again. The husband won't allow. She cannot enter into her parents' home again. The parents will throw her out that she has degraded their respectability, their prestige. Just go and commit suicide. There is no other way. Rather than committing suicide, the woman returns to the Mohammedan. That seems to be more saner and logical. Just one night a woman has to be kept out of the house. It does not matter whether she has made love to anybody or not. This is how Indian Mohammedans go on increasing in their population. Obviously, one man, four wives can give four children at least per year. The same is not possible, four husbands, one wife. It may not even give one child. Four husbands may kill the child before he is born. So remember, your God-oriented religions are only conveniences of the society. They should not be called religions. They are only moral precepts to keep the society together and in the least inconvenient way. It is not religiousness. Religiousness arises only as a blaspheming of your own consciousness. God-oriented religions certainly create a conscience, but not consciousness. And many people have the false notion that conscience and consciousness are one. Their root is one, but they are two separate branches moving in different, altogether diametrically opposite directions. Conscience is forced on you by others. Consciousness is an evolution, rising from your own depths to the ultimate heights. Conscience is just like a plastic flower. Once I had a neighbor. I had beautiful garden and all kinds of flowers and all kinds of trees. And of course, he was jealous. So what he did, because only one of his window I could see, his whole house I could not see from my house. Tall trees were hiding his house from my garden, but one window was available for me to see. He brought a pot and arranged plastic flowers in it. And just to deceive me, because plastic flowers don't need watering, he will every day water, just to show me that he has also flowers. But I saw that the same flowers continue. 6 months passed and the same flowers. I said, he has found a great flowering tree. So one day I jumped over my boundary wall and went close to the window. And I could not believe that what kind of idiot he is. He has brought plastic flowers with plastic leaves and he has planted them into a flower pot. And just to deceive me that they are real, he has to water. Only he will water when I was there to show me that his flowers are real. Plastic flowers are very permanent flowers. In fact, scientists are worried that plastic is one of the things that earth cannot absorb. And now so many plastic things are being thrown into the ocean, into the earth, that they are destroying the whole ecology. Plastic is something eternal. A tree grows out of the earth, a man grows out of the earth, and you put the tree back into the earth and it will disappear into its basic elements. But plastic is man-made. You can put it into the earth and after many years you can dig and find the plastic exactly the same. Nothing has changed. It is because of American idea of using a thing once and throwing it away. It is cleaner, but it is dangerous. The whole bottom of the ocean around America is full of plastic things, plastic bags, plastic syringes. Everything is plastic, plastic covers, plastic toys, and those layers of plastic have created a strange thing. Millions of fish have died because the plastic has made the water poisonous. Its aliveness is gone. It has become dead. And the fear is growing every day that more plastic is thrown into the oceans, into the rivers, into the earth. You will make everything dead. Just everything plastic. I knocked on his window, he came. I said, you have got great flowers. I have got very poor flowers. In the morning they blossom, by the evening they are gone. Although you have got only one pot, but it is better than my whole garden. He was very much embarrassed. And I said, you are a very intelligent man. You have been watering these plastic flowers. He had not a single word to say. His wife came behind and he said, you are saying he is intelligent? He is an idiot. I have been telling him that plastic flowers don't need water. I told her wife, you don't know, he was not watering the plastic flowers. He was trying to deceive me. And that's why I had to climb over the wall committing an illegal act to make him aware that he cannot deceive. These plastic flowers have been there for 6 months and they will remain forever. This man will die, you will die, I told his wife, but these plastic flowers will remain. They are immortal beings, but they are dead. That's why they are immortal, already dead. You cannot kill a dead man, can you? Once a man is dead, he becomes immortal. You cannot kill him twice. Resurrection has happened only once, and that was also false. Once a man dies, now there is no more death. This difference between imposed morality and religion and an inner growth of consciousness are totally different. Perhaps only in French language, conscience and consciousness are equivalent. But I am not certain, I don't know French. But I have a certain feeling that in French those two words are not different. Conscience is used for both conscience and consciousness. But it is absolutely wrong. The French linguists have to change. Conscience is God-oriented. Consciousness is your own innermost being flowering. Then you have a spontaneous response to situations. The God-oriented morality cannot have a spontaneity in it. It consults what is the Holy Scripture is saying, what Moses is saying, what Jesus is saying. It has to consult its memory system. But spontaneity has not to consult anybody. Manu, Moses, Muhammad, nobody. A spontaneous action simply arises in you, and because it arises in you, it has an authenticity, an honesty. And you are functioning as a individual, not as a sheep. You are functioning as a human being with dignity and splendor and honor. A God-oriented religion takes away everything that is beautiful in you and leaves behind just a dilapidated human being, crippled in every possible way, exploited by all kinds of parasites. God is the ultimate parasite. He goes on threatening you. Of course, because there is no God, the priest is the spokesman. And he goes on threatening you that you will be thrown into hell if you don't listen to me. I represent God. It is a pure invention of the priesthood all over the world to dominate men, to exploit men, and what they are saying to the people, they themselves don't believe. How they can believe? They know it is a fiction. But it is a very good profession. It is a good business. Just today, the Archbishop of Jerusalem, which is a holy land for three religions, Jews, Christians, Mohammedans. And the Archbishop of this holy city has been arrested in London because he was misbehaving on the railway station public toilet, exposing himself, exhibiting his sexual machinery to other people. And this is the Archbishop of Jerusalem. One cannot even believe that these people go on teaching to others celibacy and they themselves behave in such stupid ways. I have told you three bishops were going to Pittsburgh, but the woman on the window where they had to get their tickets had such beautiful tits the youngest Bishop was sent to purchase tickets. When he saw the tits of the woman, he forgot. He said, "Just give me three tickets for Pittsburgh." The woman was very angry. And the bishop felt very ashamed, so he came back. He said, "Forgive me, but I forgot completely." So the second one said, "Don't be worried, I will go." As he gave the money, he told the girl, that give me the exchange in dimes and nipples. The girl was furious. He said, "You are all idiots of the same type. Can't you behave like human beings?" He ran away, and the oldest bishop said, "Don't be worried, I will take care." And he went there and he said, "You woman, you will be in trouble. If you go showing your tits like this to the pearly gates, Saint Finger will show his Peter to you." What to do with these people? Once you repress something, It is bound to come up. You simply become a fool. Now all three bishops proved to be utterly foolish and absolute idiots, but they are victims of a constant harassment by religion, by their abbots, by their popes, against nature. All moralities are against nature and in favor of a certain social structure. And the social structure is man-made, and it is not perfect. It needs to be changed. But all moralities, God-oriented religions, are protective to the social structure. They are against any revolution. They don't have any consciousness. They have created in place of consciousness a bogus conscience, that is plastic consciousness. What they call conscience is simply implanted. It is programmed in you. So you have to act accordingly, but your inner being is not in favor. So when you want to say Pittsburgh, your inner being says Titsburg. When you want to say Saint Peter, your nature says Saint Finger. Well, so is Peter. This dichotomy is created by our God-oriented religions. Man is suffering schizophrenia, neurosis, psychosis, all kinds of mental diseases because of one fiction that he cannot drop. Just drop God and you will find yourself sinner, natural. And a certain beauty will come to you, which only comes to natural beings. If you believe in a God, you are bound to be afraid of his judgment. But if there is no God, there is no judgment, you have only a witness, and a witness is not a judge. A witness is only a mirror. It shows you clearly the situation, and it gives you a spontaneous response to it. Then it has tremendous beauty and harmony, and your life is without any regret. You don't look back. You remain constantly in the present, just a witness, acting, responding, whatever encounters you, according to your own consciousness. And remember one thing, even if you fall in hell, but you have lived spontaneously and according to your consciousness, you will not regret. But on the other hand, if you enter heaven because others forced you to act according to certain precepts, certain commandments, you will regret even in heaven that you have not lived your life according to your own nature. The There is only one blissfulness in the world, and that is to be in accordance with your nature, with your existence, and don't bother about any commandments, and don't bother about any disciplines, don't bother about any morality. Just live out according to your own consciousness and go on growing your consciousness, and soon you will see the spring, and all the flowers will bring a clarity of vision and a certainty of action, a totality to every response, and your every response will be beautiful, because it will be coming out of a growing consciousness. Conscience is borrowed, consciousness is your nature. The difference is vast. The second question: it seems life is not the ultimate value. The mechanical man is expendable. God is nothing more than a sick fantasy. Obviously, that cannot be the ultimate value. What then does that leave us with? With nothing. Just yourself. Once God is no more there, you are alone and responsible. People are clinging to God for a certain reason. They are throwing all responsibility on God. He will take care. All that we have to do is to go every Sunday to the church. That's enough. And God will take care. But you don't know, the moment you give your responsibility to God, you have also given your freedom in His hands. You have become a puppet. Once you know God is just a sick fantasy, that very understanding will make you healthy and whole. And out of your wholeness, your aloneness, is such a beautiful experience that you don't need any value, any ultimate value. You are the ultimate value. Your very being, when discovered in its totality, is a Gautam Buddha. You don't need any other value as an incentive to make the journey towards the goal. All that you need, drop all sick fantasies, and all your religions will disappear from the earth and will leave you absolutely healthy. And out of that health and aloneness, out of that freedom, you will find your ultimate peaks and ultimate depths. And this is what can be called the real meaning, the real significance, the ultimate value. You are the ultimate value. It is because of sick fantasy you are not looking at yourself, you are looking at the stars. The third question: primitive societies have always conceptualized God as parts of the environment, such as rivers, trees, and the sun and moon. As societies became more civilized, they began to conceptualize God as a separate individual. Why is this? The primitive societies had no private property. The primitive societies had no families. They were tribal. Nobody knew who is the father. People only knew about uncles and the mother. Primitive societies were matriarchal. The mother was the only person they knew. The father has not yet arrived. As societies started moving from hunting to cultivation, they stopped from being gypsies. Otherwise, they were continuously moving wherever there was possibility of finding more animals to hunt. They could not remain in one place. Soon the food will be finished. And animals were escaping from those people. So they had to follow the animals. Their whole concern was how to get the food. There were no houses, there were no cities, there were only temporary camps. And the private property has not yet arisen. But with cultivation, private property came into being. The people who were stronger managed as much land as they wanted. The people who were weaker managed to live at the very minimum, whatever was left over from the stronger gangsters. Those strong criminals have become finally your kings and your lords and your counts. These are basically criminal people who have deprived humanity much of their joys, forced them into a corner. But once private property arose, the father has to be certain that his son is his son. With private property came the family into being. And with private property, the woman was transformed into a subhuman species. She became imprisoned. Now she was nothing but property. Property of a certain man. And her whole function was to be a factory to reproduce children. The tribal people have no idea of a father. But the tribal people and the primitives had known many things that we have forgotten. They felt life surging into trees. They felt life moving into the rivers. They felt life into the tidal waves of the ocean, settling continuously, eternally on the seashore. They were more sensitive people. They were illiterate, uncivilized, but they were more sensitive and more receptive. I have heard about the native Australians. Most of them have been killed by the white men, and killed in such an ugly way that white man seems to be the most barbarous man on the earth. The native Australians were killed almost like animals. People used to go for hunting the natives because they thought them not to be human beings, a far lower species. So almost 90% of the natives of Australia has been killed and eaten by the white people, because it was hunting. Just as you hunt tigers and lions and deers, you were hunting a different species than humanity. They were not white, their faces were different, their behavior was different. But I have heard about the natives of Australia, and few scientists are still working on the project, that they had a very strange way. They had no post office, they had no telephone system, they had no wireless. They used to hypnotize a tree, a certain tree which is more hypnotizable. Their sensitivity must have found the right kind of tree that is ready to be hypnotized. In humanity, 33% people are immediately capable of being hypnotized. Only 33%. But strangely enough, only 33% people are intelligent. They are the same people. Only 33% people are creative. They are the same people. The remaining ones are insensitive, unreceptive, unintelligent. The natives of Australia have found which tree is more hypnotizable. So each village has its own hypnotized tree. And through the tree, they used to send message to another tree in another village. For example, somebody's son has gone to another village and the father wants to send a message to him. When the son was leaving, the father will say that if I have to send a message to you, I will send exactly when the sun is rising. At that time, you listen to the hypnotized tree. In that village, it may be hundreds of miles away, and early, exactly when the sun is rising, father will go to the tree of his village and he wants to send a message to the sun. He will tell to the tree that please inform the tree of a certain village where my son must be waiting for a message, and then he will talk to the tree the message, and the son will be listening to the tree 100 miles away, and the message was received that you can stay today more but finish the work, or any message. It was for thousands of years they have practiced it. But slowly, slowly, they have forgotten, most of them have forgotten how to hypnotize. Because Christianity is forcing them into schools to learn and to read. And Christianity is absolutely against hypnotism. It thinks it is something to do with the devil. Hypnotism or mesmerism or anything is counted to be dangerous. So they have destroyed those trees also with the natives, which were hypnotized for centuries. So they have become so sensitive that they immediately sent the message to the other tree, hundreds of miles away, maybe thousands of miles away. The space does not matter, neither the distance. The primitive man was very sensitive because he lived with trees, he lived with animals, he lived with rivers, he lived with oceans, he lived with mountains. He was part of nature. The primitive man had no religion, no organized church, no priesthood. Obviously, the primitive man was aware of a surging life all around. He lived amidst an ocean of life, and obviously, his love for trees, his love for rivers, his love for the ocean, his love for the high mountains, the stars, the sun and moon was immense. He lived in a totally different world, very related. He was one of the members of the cosmos, just as every living thing is. As far as sensitivity is concerned, he was far more humane than the so-called civilized man. He has become hard. He has become more mechanical, more robot-like. And he has lost much of sensitivity. You can watch holding hands with different people. Some hands will look almost as if you are holding a hand of a dead man. No energy, no warmth, no throbbing of life. No transfer of any energy, loving, friendly, just closed, dead. And you will find hands which suck you. You find afterwards that you are feeling weaker. People are there with whom you don't want to be. Because to be with them, you feel sucked out of your energy, as if somebody has taken blood out of you. They are parasites of energy. They don't have any energy to give, but they are ready to take any energy possible. And you will find the opposite also. Holding their hand, you will feel healthier, fresher, and their hands will be flowing into your being, pouring some energy into you, some love, some warmth. Just the other day, Ananda has brought one very rich woman . She owns some newspapers and magazines, a very beautiful woman. She wants to write an article about me, so she wanted a photograph with her. I took her hand in my hand, and it was a sad shock to me. The woman was smiling, but her heart was sad. I could feel in her hand immense sadness. If you are sensitive, you will be able to feel whether a person is blissful, sad, feeling unworthy, feeling a sinner, or is standing on his own feet, feeling a dignity of being human, feeling rooted, centered, feeling that he has a place in existence of his own, that he is not accidental. Existence needs him, otherwise he would not be here. The very fact that I am here shows clearly that existence needs me. There is some tremendous purpose, some destiny that existence wants me to be fulfilled. I am existence ambition, just as you are. The moment you feel this, you have a great gratitude arising in you. Out of that gratitude, the primitive man was bowing down to the trees, to the rivers, to the sun, to the moon. It was far more beautiful than going into a church and bowing down to a sad Jesus Christ. And obviously he has to be sad. He is crucified. You don't expect him to laugh. That would have been absolutely inappropriate. I would have done it. But Jesus has a long face, utterly sad. All God-oriented people you will find serious and sad. Because deep down there is doubt. Because God is not their experience, it is just a belief. And how can you make belief a truth? It will remain a belief. You can repress your doubt as much as possible in the unconscious, but it is there and very alive and kicking. It makes you sad that you are living a fictitious life, a life that is not your own, a life that others have imposed on you, and God is the most responsible for taking away your prestige, your dignity, your pride. The primitive man loved existence. To me, he was more religious than the civilized man. With the private property came the father in, but the father can protect you when you are a child. When you become young, you get married, then you have to live your life. And by that time, perhaps father will die or will become sick and old. And you have lived from your very first breath under protection of the father. He was the big man in your life, the first big man. And when you are alone, you start feeling some vacuum in you which the father used to fulfill. Hence God became the father. And a father which is not going to die. Your father betrayed you. He left you alone. And you trusted him so much. And he did not care about you that you will be left alone. And you have lived with the program from the very first breath. So when the father leaves you, and you are on your own, suddenly you feel a vacuum. That vacuum can be filled by another father, but that father cannot be a human being, because a human being has already deceived you. You are feeling hurt. You project a father which is eternal and immortal and far away and omnipotent, not like your father, whom you used to think in your childhood. You can see it. Small children continuously fighting that my dad is the greatest man in the world. Your dad is just a chicken. Every child thinks his dad is all powerful. He can do anything. Because he looks around him, he is doing all kinds of things, repairs the car, repairs the television, beats the mother. He knows he is powerful. But that powerful father, slowly, slowly, as you grow in your intelligence, you start seeing his frailties, his weaknesses. Suddenly a gap. Even if the father is alive and with you, you know he is not omnipotent. He is becoming older, soon he will die. You know he is not all-powerful. Before his boss, he starts wagging his tail. Invisible tail. But there is a place in your backbone, just at the end, where some million years ago there used to be a tail connected. The pluck is still there. That was the greatest argument by Charles Darwin. That if there was no tail connected to you, then why this space? This space will not have been here. The tail has dropped, leaving the hole, leaving the space where it used to be attached. Why you start smiling as you see your boss? You don't smile at your servant. The servant has to smile, not you. You don't take any note, you go on reading your newspaper, you know he is passing by, smiling, but you don't even look at him. The same your boss is doing with you. You smile and he goes on writing. Perhaps he is not writing anything, but just seeing you coming in, he starts getting engaged into the file, turning pages, looks very occupied and busy. I used to stay with one of the presidents of the ruling Congress party, U.N. Deber. He was very much interested in me. He used to attend my camps, even though his whole political friends prevented him, told him that don't go to this man. But he was not a politician, not cunning, very simple and very authentic man. It was just by chance, accidentally, that he has become the president. It happens in most of the cases. He was chosen the president because he was the most polite, nice, and a man who will never say no. And Pandit Jawaharlal needed a yes man. He was the Prime Minister and he wanted the organization of Congress to be ruled either by himself, which will look dictatorial, or by a yes man. And U.N. Deber was such a simple man that he will say yes to whatever Jawaharlal wanted. So it was almost Jawaharlal who was dictating everything. I was staying once in his house in New Delhi. And he was talking to me and gossiping about all the political leaders, what kind of people we have got, all kinds of idiots he was telling to me. There was one Maulana Azad, a Mohammedan, who knew no English, who knew no Hindustani. He was a scholar of Arabic and Persian, and he was the education minister of India. He was just talking about this Maulana Azad. Once Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru had gone to a conference to London, a conference of the Commonwealth Nations. At that time, India was part of the Commonwealth. Now it is no more. And Maulana Azad was the second man in the cabinet. He has been given that second place because he was a Mohammedan, to satisfy the Mohammedans of India. You will be surprised to know India is the greatest Mohammedan country. All other Mohammedan countries don't have so many Mohammedans as India. Even after Pakistan has been separated, Bangladesh has got separated, still India has more population of Mohammedans than any other country in the world. To satisfy the Mohammedans, a Mohammedan has to be number two in the cabinet. And when Jawaharlal went to London, he thought perhaps now he is the acting Prime Minister, because he is the second man. Prime Ministers are Prime Ministers wherever they are. There is no such thing as an acting Prime Minister. If the president goes out of the country, who is the head of the government, then the vice president becomes the acting president. But the prime minister is not the head of the government. In such a constitution as India or England, the prime minister is not the head, so there is no need for any acting prime minister. But he thought, and even Devar was saying to me, that we all told him that this is absolutely unconstitutional. There is no place in the constitution for any acting prime minister. There is only place for acting president. But he did not listen. He immediately phoned the chauffeur of Jawaharlal that bring his limousine to my house, and while he is away, I am the acting prime minister. And with the flag of the prime minister on the car and two motorbikes ahead and two motorbikes by the side and two motorbikes behind, he went into the parliament and everybody laughed. So you and Devar was telling me that such idiots are there, and Jawaharlal has to phone from London that don't do this stupid thing. It is absolutely unconstitutional. There is no such thing as acting prime minister. And then suddenly came a phone. He took the phone and told that I am very busy and I cannot give you any appointment for at least 7 days, and throw the phone down. I said, you are not busy, you are just gossiping with me. He said, this is the trouble in politics. You have to pretend that you are very busy, that you don't have any time, and you have all the time. But you have to show to the people that you are a very busy man, not approachable so easily. So I have told him after 7 days he should phone again. If I have time, then I will see. Although I am completely free, because you are here, I have cancelled all my programs. While you are here in my house, I don't want to waste my time with anybody else. I want to be with you. This is a rare chance, because in the camps I cannot have much time with you. This is a great opportunity, and I have told everybody, the guards, that don't allow anybody. I said, this is strange, that man may have some important work. He said, who cares? Nobody cares about anybody. Such a nice person, very cultured, educated, but who cares? The moment he said it to me, I said, this is very insensitive. And you pray every day to God. He had a small temple in his house with the statue of Krishna. He was a devotee of Krishna. Your prayer is meaningless. It is better to go outside and pray to a rose bush. At least the rose bush is alive. This Krishna that you are praying is man-made, just a stone cut into a statue, Can't you see the deadness of your Krishna? Look outside, the whole world is alive. Birds are singing, flowers are blossoming, sun is setting, soon the whole sky will be full of stars. The primitive man lived in the universe as an essential part of it, and he was grateful just to be alive. His gratitude was more authentic than the God-oriented religion's thankfulness to God. You are being thankful to a fiction. One of the English well-known linguist and writer, Dr. Johnson, had a strange habit, almost neurotic. Whenever he will go for a morning walk, he has to touch every electric pole. If he forgot to touch some electric pole, he will go back, touch it, and then go ahead. Whoever was with him will say that, "What are you doing?" He said, "What can I do? I feel such an urgency that it has to be done. I know it looks stupid, and I know there is something wrong with me, but what to do? If I leave one pole, it creates so much upset. Sentiments, emotions, feelings, that what are you doing? Just go back." And I have to go back. An electric pole? I used to go for a morning walk, and an old retired professor of mathematics started, he was also always going for a morning walk. So he became friendly with me and started going with me. But he had the habit, in India you will find temples everywhere. Just after a few houses, again a temple. If not a temple, then under the tree, a red stone representing the monkey god. And he will bow down. And I said that this is torture to me. Either you leave me or leave your gods. What nonsense! Every place and this whole city is full of temples of this god and that god, and you have to, and I have to stand with you, and I look embarrassed that what kind of companion I have got. So either you stop following me, you can go on your own way, or you have to stop this stupid habit. All those stones are dead. If you want, then look at something living. And I don't see you ever looking at the trees, looking at the flowers, or looking at the last star that is disappearing. And it is such a quiet moment in the early morning. Sun has not risen yet, it is still dark, and the last star is disappearing. At this moment, such a moment, Gautama Buddha had become enlightened. The last star was disappearing, and as the last star disappeared, something in him also disappeared. Suddenly the sky was there empty, and he looked inside. There was also utter emptiness. Two skies, one outside, one inside, and a great silence. And for the first time, he bowed down, not to anybody in particular, but to the whole existence. This is gratitude. This is authentic sensitivity. But with the private property, the father became important, and when the father was seen in his true reality, was found lacking in omnipotence, in omniscience, in omnipresence, he was not a god. So you have to create a god as a substitute for your father. So when Jesus falls down on the ground on his knees and calls Abba, in Aramaic language which Jesus spoke, he never spoke Hebrew. Hebrew was the language of the highly cultured scholars, rich people, educated people. Aramaic was the language of the villagers, uneducated people. It is Hebrew, but not sophisticated. Abba is father in Aramaic. But the way he used to fall on the ground and look at the sky and call Abba shows that he has not grown beyond his childhood. It is childless. And remember the difference between childlike and the childless. The awakened one becomes childlike. He is not childless. And the God-oriented person becomes childless. His behavior is just like a child who has lost his way in a fair and is searching for the father. Abba, he is crying where the father is. Without the father, he is not safe, he is not secure. All these prayers sow your fear. All these prayers sow your disappointment in your father. You have created a fantasy. The fantasy is sick. A little biographical note before the sutras. Sekito's enlightenment was realized while he was reading the Chaolun, a work written by Seng Chao in the year 400. Seng Chao had composed this work while in prison awaiting execution. The passage which inspired Sekito's enlightenment was, "He who makes himself to be all things of the universe, is not he the real sage? One who makes himself the whole of existence, is not he a real sage?" Just this statement suddenly transpired in him a great revolution. From ignorance, he took a quantum leap towards enlightenment. This is what I have been just saying to you. The religiousness without God simply means feeling yourself one with the whole universe. Just this statement, he must have been just on the brink, just on the borderline. And as he read this sentence, he who makes himself to be all things of the universe, is not he the real sage? And just reading this sutra, a metamorphosis. He became a totally new man. The old personality dropped, and he was for the first time an individual in tune with existence. And this man, Seng Chao, was also a great master. But the greater is a master, the more the society goes against him. He was imprisoned just because he was talking against the old religion of Japan, which is not much of a religion. It is just as ordinary religion as Hinduism, Mohammedanism, Christianity. It has no flavor of the genius and the giants. But whenever a genius and a giant appears, the little man in the masses becomes angry, feels inferior, becomes enraged, and he has killed Socrates. And he has killed Jesus, and he has killed Mansur. He also killed Seng Chao, because the whole crowd was against him. The emperor has to arrest him, because he was causing great turmoil in the country by his statements. And his statements are so beautiful that a single sentence made Sekito enlightened. Seng Chao's small book, Shaolin, is very condensed statements, because he wrote that book before he was sentenced to death. But what a man, not bothering about the death, but writing his last testament. No fear of death, no question of death. His book, you will not imagine, is written just before he was going to be sentenced. It is a small book. You will not find the shadow of the cross on it. If you don't know, you will never dream or imagine that this book has been written just before he was going to be sentenced to death. And this shows the caliber of the man. This shows the depth and the height of his enlightenment. This shows his grandeur, his splendor. A small statement in that book made Sekito enlightened and inspired by Shaolin, Sekito wrote a book called Sandokai. It is as beautiful as Shaolin. Very rarely such cases have happened in the contemporary world. It was Friedrich Nietzsche's Thus Spake Zarathustra that inspired Khalil Gibran to write The Prophet. And then his whole life he tried, and he wrote Prophet when he was only 21. And his whole life he must have written at least 50 books. In every book he is trying to go beyond Prophet but could not. Because Prophet was an inspired book. He was so overflowing with Friedrich Nietzsche's insights that they triggered him also into new spaces. Prophet is a great work, but all his other books, he wrote The Garden of the Prophet, a desire to go beyond the Prophet, but failed. At least 50 books he has written, 30 in English, 20 in Lebanese, his mother tongue, but in no other book he could even come closer to the Prophet. These books he was writing, perhaps the Prophet was written under the vast shadow of Friedrich Nietzsche's insights. It is not to be compared with Thus Spake Zarathustra, but it comes very close. The same thing happened with Seng Chao's Shaolin and Sekito's Sandokai. But the difference is that both were enlightened. So Sandokai comes to the same height as Shaolin. Neither Friedrich Nietzsche was enlightened nor Khalil Gibran. But Friedrich Nietzsche was a giant compared to Khalil Gibran. Both were unenlightened, but Nietzsche reached to the very boundary of the mind, just one step more, and he would have become enlightened. Khalil Gibran could not reach even to the boundary, that's why he never became mad. Nietzsche's madness is a symbol that he was almost ready to become enlightened but could not find the door. He had no idea that there is something beyond the mind. And he was rushing against the wall, forcing his way beyond the mind. But you cannot force your way. There is a door, you have to know the door. Meditation is the name of the door. Otherwise, you will hurt yourself by rushing against the wall. That's how he became mad. But Khalil Gibran never became mad. He never reached even to the boundary of the mind. The question of no mind does not arise. But just the shadow of Nietzsche's giant intellect triggered in him a tremendous inspiration, and he created prophets. But these two books, Chavlan and Sandokai, stand on the same ground, on the same height. You are going into Sandokai. These sutras are from Sandokai. Each statement is magical. The sutras. The mind of the great sage of India was intimately communicated from India to China. It was intimately communicated because a man of the same height as Gautam Buddha, Bodhidharma, went to China full of the light, full of the joy, full of the ecstasy. His spring has come. He went to China as the awakened one. That's why the intimate word is used. It was not transferred because before Bodhidharma reached China, thousands of Buddhist scholars have reached China. Hundreds of Buddhist scriptures were translated in Chinese. Almost the whole China has already become Buddhist before Bodhidharma reached. But none of those were awakened ones. They were great scholars who have went, translated, and the scriptures were beautiful. China has nothing compared to it. It has only one book written by a Lao Tzu on Tao, but that too does not come to the height of Gautam Buddha's sutras. Because it was a written book, and written under force, compulsion. He never wrote in his whole life, and he never spoke. People used to sit by his side just in silence. And if something happens in silence, good. If nothing happens, what I can do? That was his answer. Few people became enlightened, but very few. One Chuang-tsu, one Li-tsu, just two persons became enlightened sitting silently by the side of Lao Tzu. Because to understand silence is not easy. You have to reach to that same depth. Otherwise, you may be sitting by the side of Lao Tzu, but your mind is going in rounds, continuous rush of thoughts. You may be silent from the outside, but inside there is too much talk going on. When for the first time talking movies have come into existence, before that there were silent movies. So the first name that was given to the talking movies was talkie. And in India, the movie house is still called talkies. In your mind, that talkie is continuously going on. Whether you want or not, that does not matter. In spite of you, it is continuously there. So although thousands of Buddhist scholars has reached, the whole China was converted to Buddhism, the emperor of China was converted to Buddhism, but nobody has given the taste. It was not an intimate phenomenon. It became intimate only when Bodhidharma reached China. Now a Buddha himself has reached China. A different body, but the same consciousness. A different body, but the same height and the same depth. It is perfectly good of Sekito to call it intimate communication from India to China. In human beings, there are wise men and fools. But on the way, there is no northern or southern teacher. Neither teachers from India, nor teachers from China are of any help on the way. You need a master. You need an intimate communion with the master, not a teaching. You don't need a teacher in the real religious world. You need a master. You need a Buddha who has already arrived and who can provoke you, challenge you to come. A Buddha is nothing but a clarion call to everybody who wants to know, can come close. The master has arrived, the teacher has only heard. He has no individual, intimate experience of the truth. So in the ordinary world, there are wise people and there are other wise people. But on the path, neither the wise are of any help nor the other wise. On the path, you need someone who has gone beyond mind, beyond wisdom, beyond foolishness. Who has gone beyond intellect and beyond retardedness. Who has simply moved into the silence of the beyond. You need someone who has found the truth. Just in his finding the truth, he has become a radiation. Around him, there is a field of energy which can penetrate you, which can wake you up. The mysterious source is clear and bright. The branching streams flow through the darkness. As far as the master is concerned, the mysterious source is clear and bright. The branching streams flow through the darkness. But the moment the master speaks, his words start moving towards darkness. By the time they reach to you, they are streams flowing in darkness, branches moving towards darkness. You have to come into deep intimacy with the master, So you can share his brightness, his clearness, his clarity, his transparency. If you only hear his words and note down those words, you are already going wrong. The master does not consist of words. He may use words to call you closer. The master consists only of absolute silence, pure silence. To be attached to the relative, this is illusion. The whole world is relative. It is not only Albert Einstein to bring the word relativity into the world. Long before him, mystics in different lands have found it that everything outside is relative. But that has created a problem for the philosophers, not for the mystics. Philosophers have heard the mystics that everything outside is relative, and whatever is relative is illusory. Why it is illusory? It is a little bit subtle, but you have to understand it. You think yourself homely when you saw a beautiful woman. You see a tall man and you feel small. But your smallness is relative. If the tall man has not come, you are perfectly okay. There was no problem. You were not worried about your smallness. In India, there is a saying that the camels never like to go to the mountains. They love the deserts where there are the mountains. They live in the desert. They don't like the mountains at all, because the mountain makes them feel very inferior. It is very psychological. Why you feel that you are small, unworthy, that you don't deserve any respect, that you are a sinner? These are all relative things. That you are beautiful, that you are very educated, these are all relative. Anything relative is illusory. Illusory in the sense, if you don't compare, you are yourself, somebody else is himself. What does it matter if he is tall? What does it matter if you are small? Both of your feet reach to the earth just as the tall man's feet reach to the earth. It is not that you are small and dangling in the air. What is the problem? Comparison creates relative illusions. Trees are not worried. The rose bush is small and the cedar is going 200 feet high. Neither the rose bush is worried why the cedar is so tall. Neither the cedar is worried why the rose bush has such beautiful flowers. Rose bush is rose bush. Cedar is cedar. One Zen master was asked, why we are miserable. He said, look at the cypress tree in the courtyard. He looked at the courtyard and the cypress tree. He said, but I don't understand. He said, look again by the side of the cypress, there is a rose bush. I have never heard the rose bush complaining that why I am small. And I have never heard the cypress tree to complain that why no roses blossom. And I have gone so far away in search of the roses, 200 feet, and no roses. What kind of justice is this? No, there is no quarrel. I go every day in the morning, sometimes in dark, sometimes in the night, just to see whether they are quarreling or having a dialogue and discussion. There is absolute silence. Both are satisfied as they are, because no comparison is arising, no relative idea of inferiority or superiority is arising. The relative is called illusory because it is your creation, it does not exist anywhere. Otherwise you will get mad. You are passing by the side of beautiful trees and you can start thinking, why I am not green? You don't do it because you are not that neurotic yet. Because you don't compare, there is no problem. But you pass by a woman who is beautiful and you are a woman, immediately the comparison, anger, jealousy. But what is the problem? She has just a little longer nose. And what you will do with a long nose? In the dark, every woman is the same. Just put the light off. That's why people make love. First they put the light off. Then every woman is a Sophia Lorena. What is the difference? The same skeleton, the same bones, the same blood, the same mucus. The same deodorant. The same perspiration. The same huffing and puffing. Darkness has a great quality. It makes everybody equal. Who cares? In darkness, you can make love to the ugliest woman thinking she is Cleopatra. I have heard about a drunkard who was brought to the court because he was making love on the beach to a dead woman. A drunkard stumbled into the court. The judge asked, can't you make the difference between dead and alive? The drunkard said, I can. then why you were making love to that dead woman on the beach? He said, I thought she is English. I never thought she is dead. Ladies behave like that. That is the difference between a lady and a woman. A real woman will groan and moan and beat you. She will go crazy and scream and wake up the whole neighborhood. That is real woman. The lady is just a good lay, silently, just like a Japanese doll. You lie the doll, she closes her eyes. You put the doll back, she opens her eyes. A good lady is just a doll. Cultured, sophisticated, snobbish. So the poor drunkard was not wrong. I am in 100% favor with the poor drunkard. I don't want ladies in the world at all. The world needs real men, real women. And who cares about the neighborhood? They can celebrate if they want. Whenever you compare, the very comparison brings you into an illusory space. But to take to oneself the absolute is not enlightenment. That's what philosophers have been moving into. They think the world is illusory, so the God is the absolute, non-relative, beyond relativeness. The world is relative, changing, moment to moment. Nothing is permanent, nothing is stable, it is flux. God is absolute. Absolute is another name for God. He never changes. He is the same, always the same, from eternity to eternity. This is the philosopher's idea. Because of illusory world, he creates the extreme opposite of an absolute God. One of my professors, S.S. Rai, he is now a retired professor, old man. He loved me very much. It was because of him that I entered in the university where he was a professor. He was continuously persuading me. I was in another university. But I used to go for debates, discussions, eloquence competitions to the university where S.S. Rai was a professor. And very first time, at first sight, he fell in love with me. He was a judge, and there were three judges, and he gave me 99% out of 100 marks, and I came first, I won the shield, And as I was leaving with the seal, he came by my side and he said, "Wait, I have to apologize to you." I said, "For what?" He said, "I wanted to give you 100%. But feeling that people will think I am being favorable to you, I cut one number. I gave you 99%. Just please forgive me. I wanted to give you, but I could not be that strong. I knew that other professors will say that you are being too favorable." I said, "There is no harm. I won the seal anyway. And others have also given good numbers. Somebody has given 80%, somebody has given 85%. So there is no problem. The people are far away, the other competitors. So your not giving me one number makes no difference." He said, "It does not make difference to you, but it makes difference to me, because I went against myself. I wanted to give you 100%. I said, "Next time I will be coming again and again," because I was going to all the universities, to all the colleges, wherever there was any competition for eloquence or for debate. And it was only for one time that I got the second prize. Otherwise, I had hundreds of prizes, always first. The day I got the second prize, the whole audience of the university could not believe it. And I had to stand up. I told the Vice Chancellor who was presiding that I know why I have got the second prize, and you must be puzzling yourself also. One girl has got the first prize. I said, "I have to be absolutely clear about the matter, because I know what happened. One of the professors who is the judge is in love with the girl. And he has given too many marks to her. And the other two judges had no idea. They both have given me highest marks, but that man has given her so much that she has come only one mark ahead." And I said, "You have to ask that professor, because I know they both have been moving in the park together in the night. The park used to be in front of my house, so I know perfectly well. And I can produce witnesses, because all the gardeners in the park know that these two people come late in the night when the park is closed. And they bribe the gardeners and enter into the park, because that is the safest place in the night." The girl and the professor both started perspiring. I said, "Look at their perspiration. Nobody in this whole hall, there were at least 1,000 people, is perspiring. Only these two people, why they are perspiring?" I said, "Stand up." I said so loudly that even the professor stood up. And the Vice Chancellor said, you are creating such a trouble. But I can understand. I said, you have to cancel this whole debate. It has to be done again. And this man has not to be a judge. He felt so ashamed that he resigned from the college that very night and escaped from the town. I came across him after 20 years in a train. I said, hello. He said, my God, I wanted never to see you again. I said, life is mysterious. Where is the girl? He said, you have not forgotten yet? I said, neither I have forgotten nor I have forgiven. Where is the girl? He said, that girl, because of you, deserted me. She became so ashamed that she stopped meeting me. I said, that's great. Now I forgive you and I will forget you. I wanted to finish that relationship because you were doing injustice to me. You thought I will remain silent. And from that day, every judge was aware not to do anything because this man seems to be strange. Everybody felt that was absolute unjust. That girl was not even worth being fourth. And S.S. Rai became interested in me because what I had spoken, he loved it. And he said, I will arrange every facility for you, a scholarship, fellowship, whatever you want, I will arrange. You just change the university. I want you to be my student. He was a professor of philosophy. So I changed the university. And he was a very well-known scholar, particularly on Shankara, whose whole philosophy is that the world is illusion and the God is the absolute truth. And on Bradley, an English philosopher, whose philosophy is the same. The world is illusory and God is the absolute truth. So he had his doctoral thesis on Shankara and Bradley. And the very first day I entered his class, he has invited me, but he had not been aware that he is inviting a trouble. He was talking about illusion and absolute, the world and the God. And I told him that if God is unchanging, he must be dead. Any living thing cannot be unchanging. You show me any living thing in the whole world. Every living thing is moving, growing, going. It is constant flux. Life is a flux. If God is alive, it is not possible that he can remain stable, the same forever. Then how you will differentiate between a dead God and a living God? Just tell me. Both are sitting in front of you. The living God, the dead God. Neither the dead God changes, nor the living God changes. How you will find who is the living God? He said, my God. I have got a doctoral degree on my thesis, but I never thought about this. I said the very word absolute is a reaction. First you call the world illusory, which it is not. You know perfectly well. You don't enter into anybody's house. If it is illusory, what does it matter? Why you go on entering into your own house every day? What does it matter? You can enter into somebody's house. He said, your philosophical discussion is dangerous. I have discussed problems, but you are telling me to enter into somebody else's house? I said, yes. Because if it is illusory, I'll dream. What does it matter? Whether it is your wife or somebody else's wife, whether they are your children or somebody else's children, all is illusory. In your God is only a philosophical concept. Because the world is changing, God has to be unchanging. But it is only a logic. If there is a God, he has to be changing, otherwise he will be dead. And I told him that day, the first day of my encounter into his class, that God is certainly dead. That's why he is not changing. But this absolute idea of God is only a philosophical concept. That's why Sekito says, to be attached to the relative, this is illusion. He is not saying that the world is illusion. To be attached to this world is illusion. Remain unattached, the world is perfectly real. Attachment is illusion, not the world, not the woman, but the attachment, not the money, but the attachment, not the body, but the attachment. Sekito is making a tremendously significant statement. No philosopher has said that. They say the world is illusory. He is making a distinction, not the world, but the attachment to the world, to the relative, is illusory. And because of this, philosophers have moved to the other extreme. God is not illusory. He is the most real, the absolutely real. And Sekito immediately encounters these philosophers. He says, but to take to oneself the absolute is not enlightenment. Don't think in terms of absolute. There is nothing absolute. Everything is becoming always absolute. But it is becoming and becoming and becoming, and it never comes to a full stop, because full stop will be death. The day the existence has come to perfection, there is nowhere to go. A full stop. Perfection is death. To be absolute is to be dead. Sekito is saying something which only a mystic, only a Buddha can say. that even the experience of Buddhahood goes on growing. There are no limits of its growth. It is not that once you have become a Buddha, you have come to the full point. No, the path is endless. The journey is infinite. The pilgrimage goes on and on and on. And that is the beauty of existence, that nothing comes to an end. Everything goes on moving eternally. So the concept of the absolute is the concept of the philosophers, not of those who are enlightened. Each and all the elements of the subjective and objective spheres are related and at the same time independent. He is saying the outer world and the inner world both are independent but related, because their functions are different. They are related because they cannot exist separately. The outer cannot exist without the inner. The inner cannot exist without the outer. So they are related, but their functions are different. The outer is moving towards the objects, and the inner is moving towards subjectivity. Their directions are different. Their realizations are different, but they are related at a point. He is making immensely significant statements which will be clear to you only when you stand at your very center, absolutely clear. No dust in your eyes, and you see the objective world has a beauty of its own, a reality of its own, a life of its own, a hidden consciousness of its own, just as the inner has its own stars, its own sky, its own expanse, its own universe. Outside you there is an infinite universe. Inside you also there is an infinite universe. Both are related. Both are dependent on each other, but their functions are different. If you move on the outer line, you will find becoming more and more scientific. If you move on the inner line, you will find becoming more and more a mystic. Related yet working differently, though each keeps its own place. Form makes the character an appearance different, sound, taste, smell distinguish comfort and discomfort, the dark makes all things one, the brightness makes all things different. But it is only appearance. In darkness you cannot see, hence everything seems to be one. In light you can see, hence everything seems to be separate. But these separate things in their deepest roots are joined. We are all joined to one center of the universe. As branches, as leaves, we are separate. But as we go deeper into the roots, all the branches, all the leaves, all the flowers, are getting the nourishment from the same roots. Existence nourishes you and the trees and the mountains and the birds equally. So it is a mystery that one existence manifests in so many ways. This variety of expressions makes life beautiful. This variety makes life unboring. The variety is a richness, but this oneness makes life equal. Nobody is inferior, nobody is superior. Hence, there is no need of any comparison. The four elements return to their nature as a child to its mother. That's what I have been telling you. When the source of life also becomes the goal of life, the circle is complete. And whenever the circle is complete, you don't have to move unnecessarily into birth and death, and again birth and again death. You have been moving into this wheel of birth and death for millions of years. It is time to jump out of the circle. This very jumping out of the circle is enlightenment. Fire is hot, wind moves, water is wet, earth hard, eyes sees, ears hear, the nose smells, the tongue tastes, one salt, another sour, each is independent of the other, but the different leaves come from the same root. You taste from your tongue, you see from your eyes, you touch from your hand. All your senses are different. You cannot see by your hand, and you cannot taste by your eyes, and you cannot smell by your ears. They are all separate, but they are all joined in one brain, from where they come like separate branches, but they all feed the same brain, and the same brain nourishes them. Whatever hands bring from touch reaches to the same brain. Whatever noses bring from fragrances reaches to the same brain. Eyes bring their survey of the world to the same brain. These senses are just branches spreading in different directions to collect different experiences and to make the brain richer. But they are all rooted in one brain. He is just giving an example. We are all separate, independent, but we are rooted in the same existence. We should be independent, we should be individuals, but we should not forget that finally we are one, waves of the same ocean. Basu wrote, "What happiness crossing this summer river, sandals in hand. A man who is enlightened, everything to him becomes mystery." Now such a small thing, you will say, what is there? What happiness crossing this summer river, sandals in hand. You will say there is nothing in it. Sandals in hand, summer river must have become very shallow. What is there to be happy? But that is the very point of Zen. You don't have any reason to be happy. Even this, crossing the summer river, sandals in hand, what happiness! Any act or no act, doing or no doing, becomes utterly blissful. It does not have to be caused by something. When your happiness is caused, you become attached to the cause. Because you are afraid if you lose the cause, your happiness will disappear. If you are happy with a woman or with a man, you become attached. Not only attached, you start creating prisons for each other, because without this woman, without this man, you cannot be happy. So your happiness turns into misery for both. Meditation brings you a great experience that happiness need not be caused. And when you have found a happiness which is not caused by anything, you are simply happy. Just to be is to be happy. Then you don't create any prisons for anybody. Then you don't possess anybody, and you don't destroy anybody's dignity as a human being. You don't enslave people. You love, you share, just because of your abundance. Not that you want anything in return. Without your asking, much comes to you. The moment you start asking, you have lost the very ground of being happy. Hence, I have been contradicting Jesus' statement. He says, "Seek and ye shall find." And I say unto you, don't seek and ye shall find. Jesus says, ask and ye shall be answered. And I say unto you, don't ask and you are the answer. Jesus says, knock and the door shall be opened unto you. I say to you, there is no need to knock, the doors are already open. They have always been open, just open your eyes. Manisha's question. Friedrich Nietzsche condemns man for his lack of creativity in not being able to produce a better concept of God than the Christian one, which he regards as the sickest, the most decrepit, which he calls this pitiable God of Christian monotonotheism. Do you agree that the Christian version of God is the most ugly? Manisha, all concepts of God are fiction. So there is no question of any god being ugly or beautiful. God does not exist. Nietzsche has forgotten that God is dead. That's what happens to people who are not enlightened. Now he has been writing about God is dead, and suddenly he starts talking about that man is not very creative because he has not been able to produce a better concept of God. That will be a better fiction only, a better lie. But he has forgotten completely that he has declared God is dead. And even if it was a better fiction, it would have been still dead. Fiction is fiction, lie is lie, however polished, however refined, you cannot make it true. So Christian God or Hindu God or Mohammedan God, it does not matter. God is a fiction, and fiction is out of the sickness of mind. Because he was a Christian, and he has no other idea of Eastern gods. He had only the idea about the Jewish God and the Christian God. If he had known the Hindu gods, he would not have written this sentence. Christian God is not the only ugly God. All gods are ugly in different ways. But in the first place, they are lies. So there is no need to define. Man certainly is not creative, but that does not mean that he should create a better God. A better God will be a better prison. A better God will be a far more stronger chains. A better God will destroy you more efficiently than the ordinary gods are doing. Do you want a better God? A better prison? A better poison? Nietzsche has completely forgotten that lies are lies. There are no good lies and there are no bad lies. Lies are simply lies. You cannot make the distinction. Truth is truth. There is no better truth. You cannot refine it. Lies are lies. You can refine them, but still they will be lies. They cannot become truth. So I cannot agree, Manisha, with Nietzsche. He has forgotten. That is the trouble with philosophers. He is a great philosopher, but not beyond the mind. He cannot have the clarity of the enlightened person. Man is certainly not creative, but his creativity should not be concerned with God. His creativity should be concerned with making a better world, a better society, better literature, better poetry, better paintings, better sculpture, better human beings. A better guard is not needed. A better guard will be more dangerous. I hate the very word guard, and I will hate more if somebody refines the concept of guard. Because lies has to be destroyed, and you cannot destroy them unless you hate them. All your love for God has to be completely demolished. Now it is right time for Sardar Gurdayal Singh. He is a great iconoclast. He destroys things so creatively, Dilly Dump is the manager of the last resort old people's home. One morning he is going from house to house collecting donations. Throughout the nice mediocre American suburb called Peak Acres. Dilly walks up to the Polk household and rings the doorbell. When Porky Polk answers the door, Dilly says, "Good morning, sir. Would you like to make a contribution to the last resort old people's home?" "Okay," replies Porky. Then he turns around and calls back to the house, "Hey, Grandma, get your hat and coat on." The famous psychiatrist, Dr. Mindbender, is sitting in his chair and looking intently at his patient, Moshe Finkelstein. Dr. Mindbender closes his notebook, smiles and says, "Yes, Mr. Finkelstein, I am pleased to pronounce you are 100% cured." "Rats," sighs Moshe, looking depressed. "What happened?" "I don't understand," replies the shrink. "Are you not happy? I have cured you." "Happy?" asked Moshe. "Why should I be happy? Last week I was Jesus Christ and now I am nobody." It is 9 o'clock in the morning in the Glorious Endings funeral parlor on the little Greek island of Crete. Papa Acid Apholis, the undertaker, hears the phone ring and picks it up. "This is Bishop Creighton," says the voice at the other end. "There has been an accident at the Holy Orthodox Church of our Blessed Bleeding Virgin." "I am sending over the church janitors, Restus and Leroy, with the dead body immediately." "Right," says Papa Acid Apholis. "I will get the formal dehide ready." And he puts down the phone and dashes off into his embalming room, rubbing his hands with glee. 3 hours later, Restus and Leroy come in carrying old Mrs. Soflaki, who is as dead as a dodo. "Jesus Christ," shouts Papa Acid Apholis, looking at his watch and shaking his fist. "Bishop Creighton called me 3 hours ago. What took you guys so long?" sorry boss, draws lila, but we had to wait until the good bishop had finished preaching to find out which one of the old ladies was dead. Close your eyes and feel your body to be completely frozen. This is the right moment to go inwards. Gather your energies, your total consciousness, and rush towards your center with a great urgency, as if this is going to be your last moment. Only with such urgency one can reach to the center immediately. Faster and faster, deeper and deeper. As you are coming closer to the center, a great silence descends over you, just like soft rain, very tangible, very cool, a little more closer. And you found a tremendous peacefulness surrounding your inner space. Flowers of the beyond, start raining on you. One step more and you are at the center. For the first time, you see your original face. For the first time, you encounter your eternity. The East calls this original face the face of the Buddha, the awakened one. It has nothing to do with Gautam Buddha personally. It is everybody's original face, peaceful, graceful, with a grandeur, with tremendous clarity, transparency, majesty. Your splendor is great. Your treasure is great. Just one quality of the Buddha has to be remembered. He consists only of one quality, witnessing. This small word, witnessing, contains the whole spirituality. Witness that you are not the body. Witness that you are not the mind. Witness that you are only a witness. As the witnessing deepens, you start becoming drunk with the divine. This is what is called ecstasy. To make the witnessing deeper, nivedana, relax, let go of the body and the mind. Just remember only one thing, you are a Buddha, a witness, a pure eternal awareness, and by you will start feeling a certain melting, separations disappear. Gautam the Buddha auditorium becomes an ocean. 10,000 Buddhas disappear into the ocean. This oceanic consciousness is the very essence of Zen. The very essence of authentic religiousness. Gather as much as you can of all the ecstasy, of all the divine drunkenness, all the flowers that are showering on you, the grace, the beauty, the truth, the godliness. You have to bring them with you, and you have to express them in their utter beautifulness in your day-to-day activity. Chopping the wood, you are a Buddha. Be graceful with the tree. It is also a potential Buddha. Carrying water from the well, be a Buddha. Every act has to turn into grace, into gratitude. Only then Buddha will be coming closer and closer to you. Before Nivedana calls you, persuade the Buddha to come behind you as a great presence. Persuade him to remain with you 24 hours a day. His presence is going to become the alchemy of your transformation. These are the three steps. On the first step, Buddha comes behind you. You feel his warmth, his love, his compassion, his beatitude. On the second step, you become the shadow. Buddha comes in front of you. In the third step, your shadow disappears into the Buddha. You are no more, only Buddha is. You are no more, only existence is. God is dead, and Zen is the only living truth. Nivedana, come back, but come back as a Buddha. Even your movement should be graceful and beautiful, blissful, radiating your consciousness and awareness. Sit for a few moments to remind yourself the golden path that you have traveled and the inner space that you have touched, tasted the fragrance of the beyond that is still surrounding you, and the presence of the Buddha who is just behind you, almost touching you. Let Buddha become your very reality, and you dissolve yourself. You disappear completely. You are the disease. The Buddha is the cure. You are birth and death. Buddha is transcendence from the circle of birth and death. You are momentary, just a soap bubble. Buddha is your eternity.
The responses to sutras and voice recording on this audio format are the copyright of Osho International Foundation. Copyright dates 1953 through 2003. All rights reserved. Reproduction in any media is prohibited.